Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are turning our attention to neutrinos, and I bet you know all about neutrinos, or maybe you don't. We're going to learn about neutrinos and something called the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory. It's at the South Pole and recently underwent a major upgrade. And I think it's exciting. It's an exciting project. I know it's excited a lot of scientists around the world. And our two guests today, researchers at UW-Madison, have both visited the facility in Antarctica many years apart for the two of them. So we'll get a couple different perspectives. I think one of the folks is UW-Madison physics professor, Justin Vandenbroek. Justin, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Great to have you with us. Also with us today is, and you were there, by the way, what, 20 years maybe ago?
Yeah, over 3 years, about 20 years ago.
Yeah, you were there a long time and did a lot of work over 3 years there. Delaney Butterfield is a UW graduate research assistant, and you were just there not too long ago.
Yeah, I was there all of December and all of January this past field season.
You know, some people would say December and January in Antarctica?
Yeah. So it's actually summer there, believe it or not. Yeah. Not really summer temperatures. Still pretty cold, but it was Southern Hemisphere, so our seasons are flipped. So
yeah. Yeah, so there you go. Well, we're going to find out about your experiences there as we move along. And as you listen to our two guests, I hope you'll join the conversation. What questions you have about their work, maybe, or maybe about living in Antarctica, how they help maybe build and boost the power of the world's oldest neutrino telescope. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Justin, let me turn to you first. As we were talking before the show started, I can remember talking about this project almost before it, before it actually started with UW Research, isn't that back in the 90s?
That's right. In the 90s, there was a project led by UW-Madison and collaborators around the world, and that was a project called AMANDA. And the idea was to demonstrate whether this crazy idea of doing astronomy using neutrinos was actually possible. And not only whether it was possible, but whether you could do it in ice rather than water. And basically, people at the time installed these very precision, sensitive light detectors in the ice at the South Pole. And after years in R&D and demonstrating that they could develop and install the technology, they detected neutrinos from the atmosphere.
And so what are neutrinos, Delaney?
Neutrinos are a very small particle. They are nearly massless, so they travel at nearly the speed of light. And they are completely neutral, which means that they aren't deflected at any magnetic fields. And they're also weakly interacting, which is great because that means that they aren't scattered or absorbed as they travel to our detector. But it also means that it's really hard to detect them. So they come in a few different flavors, and they also oscillate between flavors, which is part of the science goals of this recent upgrade that we just installed this past field season. But then they also carry a lot of information about their source and where they come from, and that's where the neutrino astronomy comes into play.
Yeah. So why in the heck are we worried about these? And are they going through us as we speak?
They are going through us. There's trillions going through us every second.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't feel like a piece of Swiss cheese.
That's what Delaney said. They travel straight through us almost all the time. It's very rare that they ever collide with an atom.
Well, why don't we just take pictures of them right here in the studio? Why can't we do that?
So we need a very clear medium to actually be able to see the neutrinos, because when they interact, They, so like an ice cube, for example, these neutrinos are traveling through the ice. They'll interact with the ice and then create a secondary particle. And that particle is going to be traveling faster than the speed of light in ice. And that's going to create kind of a sonic boom, but with light. And that's called Cherenkov radiation, which is like a blue flash of light. And so that's what we actually see. So when they're traveling through us, they're probably not interacting. And even if they were, we wouldn't be able to see that Cherenkov light because we need that really clear medium, which for us is the Antarctic ice.
And that ice is there's a reason why that Antarctic ice is good ice to view this, Justin.
Right. When you think about the fact that most of these neutrinos travel straight through people and straight through everything, it's very rare that they hit an atom, as I mentioned, and so you need a lot of atoms. And as Delaney explained, the way that we detect these neutrinos is when they shatter an atom, they eventually make a flash of detectable light. And so you need to monitor a huge number of atoms in an optically clear, transparent material. And so when you think about where can you find huge numbers of atoms in an optically clear material, the ice at the South Pole is among the best places in the world to do this.
And, you know, when I look at the ice cubes in my freezer, they're not as clear as I'd like them to be. So there's a lot of air in that, if I'm not mistaken. But the ice at the South Pole is crushed a little bit more than the ice that's in my freezer.
Yeah, that ice fell originally as snow. It's a desert, but it does snow a bit. And the snow, of course, is very white, just like the snow we're used to in Wisconsin. And more snow falls on top of that. It eventually compresses that snow. It gradually compresses it over many years into ice. That ice initially is just like the ice in the freezer. It's full of bubbles. And that's milky white. It's not useful at all for neutrino astronomy. But as the snow on top keeps falling, eventually those bubbles are compressed and compressed. Eventually they go into solution inside the solid ice, and it becomes crystal clear.
It's an amazing, especially when you get down a mile and a half.
Yep, that's how deep ice cube is.
It's amazing that there's that much. I mean, is the ice even deeper than a mile and a half? Are you going right to the bottom? Or I know Antarctica is, there's land there. The North Pole is different. It does not have land under it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's about 10,000 feet of ice, 9,000 to 10,000 feet of ice at the South Pole.
So 2 miles, or closer to 2 miles,
yep,
than a mile and a half. Actually, Trevor in Appleton has a question for you. Let's go there. Trevor, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, cool. So really great to hear from Justin and Delaney. Excited to hear about this show. So I studied architecture at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and one of our architectural studio projects was to study Arctic ice with the goal of designing, fabricating, and installing long-term research facilities in that environment. So just curious to hear from Justin and Delaney what their experience was in terms of the built environment when they were doing their research.
Ah, interesting. So what have you got down there for, you know, you just don't, it's not like the original folks down there that were trying to get to the pole with dog sleds and use tents.
Yeah, when I was there working on construction of the original ice cube array, that was between 2005 and 2008, there was the iconic dome, the geodesic dome that a lot of people have probably seen in photos, and that was being demolished in those years, and there was a gradual transition to the new station, which you might have also seen photos of. It's a modular, modern structure with windows. Looks like a basically normal building, but in a remote outpost. And that's a great facility now for living and working at the South Pole. Maybe Delaney can explain her experience.
Yeah, talk some more about it.
Yeah, so one really interesting thing about all of the buildings at the South Pole is they're all on, like, stilts. So every few years, they go through a cycle of raising all of the buildings because of the snow accumulation.
Oh.
So, yeah, so like every few years, or maybe longer than a few years, but they'll have to like raise the station so that the snow accumulation doesn't like cover it up. Same with the Ice Cube Lab over in what we call the dark sector, which is where all of the astronomy goes on at the South Pole. All of the buildings in the dark sector get raised periodically. But the station is great. It's just like kind of a big dormitory, but there's a gym, there's reading rooms, there's places to watch movies. It's definitely not the worst place to be stuck for a few months.
So that's in the quote-unquote summer of December and January. How's it heated? I mean, I was thinking, oh, you could probably use solar down there for some of it because it's that time of the year, it's light the whole time. Is it not, or am I wrong?
Yes, it is light. 24 hours of daylight. Yeah. In the summer months.
In the summer months. So how are the buildings heated? I mean, what's the temperature first?
The temperature, when I was there this past field season, ranged, the air temperature fluctuated a little bit, but the feels like temperature with the wind and everything ranged from like minus 30 to minus 50 most days, averaging about minus 40.
Well, it's warm.
Yeah,
not real warm. not real warm. I mean, is the place insulated? I may be testing. You know, this is probably nothing that you have thought too much about, but I was just curious.
Yeah, it's very well insulated.
Yeah, I would think so. And how do you? How are the basic supplies handled? I mean, you got to, do you melt some of the ice for water or what, how does that work?
Yeah, so we get all of our like food and supplies for the station on cargo. So most of it will be either flown or on a vessel to McMurdo Station on Ross Island, which is off the coast of Antarctica on the Ross Ice Shelf. And then from McMurdo, it will go via C-130 or LC-130, or Overland Traverse to the South Pole. And that's how we get all of our, like, cargo and supplies.
And it's traversed, I suppose, some sort of caterpillar-type?
Yeah, so there's, like, modules, mm-hmm. like, little houses, kind of, that they pull that the Overland Traverse team lives in and mm-hmm. sleeps in. And it takes about a month to get from McMurdo Station to the South Pole via the Overland Traverse. That's how we got a lot of our equipment for the installation. So it's not just station cargo. It's also research materials.
Research materials as well. Louise in Dodgeville has a question that more to the point of neutrinos, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I had a question about dark matter. And if neutrinos are dark matter, and if they're not, if your guest could explain what dark matter is?
Ah,
that's a great question. So dark matter makes up a large fraction of the universe. It's actually more matter than the visible matter, the normal matter that we see every day. And basically, we can measure its imprints throughout the universe through its gravitational effects. It interacts normally in terms of gravity, but as far as we can tell, it does not interact any other way. So scientists around the world in lots of different projects are trying to figure out if it does interact in other ways. And that's one thing we're working on with Ice Cube. If the dark matter is made of subatomic particles, as some people think it is, then it might decay or annihilate with its own antimatter, that could also be a type of dark matter, to produce neutrinos and other particles that we could detect.
So, Louise, does that help?
Yeah, thank you so much.
And the next question is, why does it matter?
Why do neutrinos matter?
Yeah.
So the whole crazy idea of neutrino astronomy is that most astronomy that we've been doing since, you know, humans were looking up at the sky is using visible light and then extending that into non-visible light throughout the electromagnetic spectrum. That includes ultraviolet, infrared, even radio waves, X-rays, and so on. You can do astronomy with the entire electromagnetic spectrum, every type of visible and non-visible light. But the idea of neutrino astronomy is using other particles, neutrinos in this case, to do astrophysics using neutrinos. So in the same way that X-rays enable you to see deep inside of objects, neutrinos are like super X-rays. We can see even deeper into the most extreme and most obscured environments in the universe.
So you can get everywhere. Astrophysics, somebody always has a question relating to that. What is it?
Astrophysics is the study of the stars and the contents of the universe, including the lives and deaths of stars and black holes of all sizes, some comparable to stars, some massive, up to millions and billions of times the mass of stars.
Well, we are I'm having fun. I hope our guests are having fun. And I hope you're having fun, too, as you listen into our discussion today as we talk about the Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at the UW-Madison's Physics Department. There, the UW was the lead on this, and I want to get to also talk about this kind of a worldwide thing in many ways, and we'll get to that as well. You may have a question, too, and if you do, or maybe a comment, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today as we talk with Justin Vandenbroek, a physics professor at the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison. Works out of the physics department. He helped build the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole. I think you were a grad student at the time, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I started grad school and learned about the Ice Cube project and got the opportunity to go help build it at the South Pole.
Well, and here we have a current graduate student, Delaney Butterfield, as well. Delaney, a grad research assistant at the Astrophysics Center, and recently returned from the South Pole, where she helped upgrade the Neutrino Observatory. And I want to learn some more about, obviously, we want to learn some more about that as we move along today. If you have a question or comment, I see we have some coming in. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And you know what? Let's go to Jeff and Barry Mills, who has, an interesting question, too. Jeff, hi.
Good morning. Or good afternoon, I'm sorry. I was wondering how those neutrinos move. Are we bombarded from outer space, or do they move horizontally on the Earth's surface in waves, or individually, or, I mean, how close are they together? All kinds of questions like that.
Yeah, interesting. How do they travel, kind of, I guess?
Yeah, so neutrinos are particles, like we've been talking about, and there's also a lot of them. I mean, we were talking earlier about how there are trillions passing through us at each second. And because they are neutral, they travel pretty much in a straight line from their source, meaning that we, when we detect them, can point them back to where they came from using reconstruction techniques in our like algorithms and analysis.
So they're coming, could they be coming from all directions, though? I mean, they're straight line, but
yeah,
the straight, talk about that.
Yeah, so they could come from any direction. Ice Cube sees neutrinos that pass through the Earth. We also see them from what we call the southern sky, which is the sky above the South Pole. So yeah, any direction.
Very cool. There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Bobby called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to know where neutrinos originate from.
That's what I spend a lot of my waking hours wondering about. As Delaney mentioned, we can see them from not just the sky overhead at the South Pole, as you would with a normal telescope, but also from the northern sky going all the way through the Earth. And so we've measured neutrinos as basically a constant glow coming from throughout the universe, mostly from beyond our galaxy. We also recently discovered that the galaxy itself glows brightly in neutrinos. And for the most part, we don't know what's producing either the extragalactic or the galactic glow of neutrinos. We have identified a handful of sources, which are giant black holes very distant from the galaxy. But it's an outstanding mystery what's producing most of these neutrinos, and that's what we're one of the things we're busy working on.
Yeah. So the trillion that just hit me a second ago, how long did it take those neutrinos to get to me?
So the trillions that we mentioned, okay, there are two. That's the speaking generally about neutrinos.
Yeah, of course.
So about half of those come from the sun, from the fusion processes that we know happen in the sun. Another half are left over from the Big Bang. And actually, Ice Cube is not directly studying either of those. We're studying much more energetic ones, much more energetic than humans can produce at our particle accelerators. And those ones can take millions to billions of years to reach us from their sources in these black holes or other origins.
A long, long time. Faith in Reedsburg, what's on your mind?
I was wondering if you're seeing more, any more or less color in the, that would, we would see with our eyes in the color spectrum, or maybe it is just a black hole, or is it white? Is it a white light? Is it, is there a light? Is there any kind of different colors in the spectrum?
Actually, Delaney, let's go to Delaney for that.
Yeah, so when we talk about neutrino astronomy, this is in the sort of topic of multi-messenger astronomy, which is doing astronomy with more than just light. So we were talking earlier about how historically astronomy has been done by looking up at the sky and seeing what's up there, basically. And we can also see that in X-rays and UVs. So neutrino astronomy is sort of like looking at the sky and detecting things in light. But instead of light, it's a particle. So not exactly a color like you were asking, but similar in the sense that we can map these objects and study these astrophysical objects, but now with a particle instead of a photon.
So tell us about the project, and Delaney, maybe you can talk about this now. Here we had Justin was building the first one, and you said to yourself, well, we could do better than that. I don't know that it went quite that way, but I mean, tell us about what was going on and why we needed to sort of update, I guess.
Yeah, so the upgrade is designed to target lower energy neutrino physics. So the upgrade, or the original Ice Cube array, targets higher energy neutrinos above 1 TeV. I'm not really sure how to contextualize that energy unit, but above 1 TeV. And the upgrade, which is a denser infill array inside the original 86 string array, is really designed to target lower energies in the GeV range. And so this dense instrumentation is to be able to more efficiently detect less light. So if we have a lower energy particle, it's not going to produce as much light. And these lower energy neutrinos are where the neutrino oscillations happen. So we can study more about the actual properties of the particle versus the higher energy is really where we're studying, like where they come from. So it's sort of a shift in focus in terms of the science goals, but they all work together very closely.
Yeah, I would think so. But the goal with this new setup, though, I mean, how is it going to help in our understanding of the universe?
Sure, sure, yeah. So things that we don't fully understand about neutrinos yet are their mass, because they are very small.
Yeah.
So we actually can't, or we haven't measured their masses directly. Instead, we have what we call a mass ordering, which is the masses of the neutrinos in relation to each other. We also don't know exactly how they oscillate, so how they change what we call flavors. So understanding like their oscillation patterns more can also help us understand more about the particle itself. And yeah, so because these are weakly interacting and very small, these parameters are very difficult to measure and detect directly.
And I want to go back. We've talked about the array a bit, but I don't think we really, and that's on me, we really didn't describe what this kind of looks like in at the South Pole. And so, Justin, go ahead and talk about that, because you've got a pretty large area, reasonably speaking, I think.
A very large area. It's called Ice Cube because it's a cubic kilometer of ice. So imagine a kilometer distance and then cube that. That's enough volume of ice to contain a billion tons of ice. So when we talked earlier about how it's very improbable that any neutrino hits an atom, that's why you need such a huge volume to have so many atoms that you can monitor for neutrino collisions. And when one of these neutrinos occasionally collides with an atom, it shatters it, and those fragments of the atom make a flash of light. And we have this array of 5,000 sensors in the ice. That was before this new upgrade. Now there's much more. And those sensors in the ice have what are called photomultiplier tubes. They're kind of like light bulbs in reverse. They convert a flash of light into a flash of electricity. And we record that at this array, and we can use that to calculate where each neutrino came from on the sky.
And we're not talking about digging a little hole in the ice here.
Right. Each hole is about a mile and a half deep. That's why you have to go so deep, first to span such a large volume, and second to get below those bubbly section of ice that's more shallow that we talked about earlier. There's also a huge background of other subatomic particles coming from the atmosphere all the time. And the deeper you go, the more you avoid that background noise.
That makes sense. Well, I thought it was cool is how you get down a mile and a half.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. You just...
simple
in concept, very challenging in engineering. So that was the major success of the Ice Cube project, that the engineering triumph of doing this at such a large scale in such a difficult environment. So this was a collaboration between the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center that you mentioned earlier and the Physical Sciences Lab, also at UW in Stoughton. And they designed this, it's called the Enhanced Hot Water Drill, and it's basically a means of producing hot water at as high temperature and pressure as you can, and then just squirting it in the ice. And you just keep squirting, keep heating, keep squirting, and you get this, in only a couple days, you get a hole that's a mile and a half deep.
And you were down there for that, weren't you, Delaney?
Yeah, so I got to the South Pole on December 1st of this past winter. And when I got there, we were actually trying to prep the drill, or the drill team was trying to prep the drill to commence drilling for the upgrade. Because a lot of this equipment is very old, from the days of Amanda, older than I am. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge undertaking just to get this equipment back in shape to drill more holes. So the drill team did a great job getting that prepped. But yeah, it took a few days to actually drill the holes, because in addition to going down, you also have to come back up, get the drill head out, and then it took a full 24 hours for the installation team, which I was a part of, to get the devices in the hole and lower the string. So all in all, it took I think between 4 and 5 days on average to drill the hole and finish installing it.
And you know, when you drill a hole, I mean, and it's 40 below zero, the hole, you know, I've done a lot of ice fishing, you know, and the holes freeze up pretty quick, even at 20 degrees Fahrenheit, let alone 40 below.
Yeah, so part of the enhanced hot water drill is the immense amount of pressure that it's under, or that the water is under. So we're drilling at about 200 gallons per minute, which is a lot of water, and also at about 80 degrees Celsius, which is just below boiling. I mean, boiling is 100. So that combination, and also our team of engineers has multiple thermal models on how this hole should look, what the rate of drilling should be. So this is very well studied in terms of how long does the hole need to be drilled, how long will the hole be what we call like alive, like what's the lifetime of the hole? So how long do we have before we can no longer install our devices in it? And then it actually takes a few weeks for the hole to completely freeze, just because it is so deep.
Yeah.
So it actually kind of freezes upside down. So it freezes from the top bottom generally, because the surface is actually much colder than the bottom, because the bottom of the hole is closer to the earth. So we have the heat from the earth kind of like warming up the bottom of the ice.
But I'm still, and I want to get to Sitchin in just a second here, but I'm still amazed at how do you get down a mile and a half? Do you have a long hose that's, I mean, you actually run a hose of water?
Yeah, we have a massive spool that's behind our drilling and installation tower that goes over the tower and into the hose. It's over a mile and a half long. Yeah, it's made up of segments that are coupled together, but it is a very long hose.
It is indeed. Let's go to, I've got some more on that, but let's go to Sitch in Madison. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. I am wondering how fast neutrinos travel and also how they get accelerated to that speed in the first place.
Hmm.
Yeah, so neutrinos have almost zero, but not quite zero mass. And that means that they travel almost at the speed of light. So for all practical purposes, you can say they travel at the speed of light. It's a smidge below the speed of light. And how do they get accelerated? So as Delaney explained earlier, they don't have electric charge. And so you cannot accelerate them using the usual methods of electric and magnetic fields that we use in human-constructed particle accelerators. They're produced by other energetic particles. So one of the main purposes of IceCube is to understand the cosmic particle accelerators that we know are abundant in the universe and reach energies millions of times more energetic than humans have figured out how to achieve. And those energetic particles called cosmic rays, they produce neutrinos either while they're traveling across the universe or directly in their sources. So it's the neutrinos reach high energies because they're the particles from which they originate are accelerated to very high energies.
So at the speed of light, and you were talking earlier that it might take a million years for a neutrino at the speed of light to make it to my hand here as I put my hand up, might have been from a million years ago.
A million or even a billion. So if you think
even
about
a billion.
Yeah, some of these giant black holes we've detected are a billion light years away. And so that neutrino started its journey a billion years ago when, you know, early in the Earth's evolution, and then that evolution continued. Life evolved, humans evolved, astronomers evolved, then particle physicists evolved. Luckily, they constructed IceCube in time for that flash of neutrinos to arrive after traveling a billion years across the universe.
Amazing story. Dana emailed to ask what scientists observed in neutrinos during the close flyby of 31 Atlas comet in December? Is there anything that you would have?
I think that's the one that the Vera Rubin Observatory detected. It's the latest of these interstellar objects that are very exciting in terms of their astronomy. As far as I know, they don't have a direct connection to IceCube and neutrino astronomy.
Jeff wonders, do they collide? Do neutrinos collide? And if they do, what happens?
Neutrinos are weakly interacting, like I have mentioned a few times. So they do collide with atoms in the ice. That's what creates the interaction that IceCube detects. As far as colliding with each other, Justin, do you know more about that?
In principle, they can collide with one another. It would be a very rare event, but like any other particles, they could collide and produce other particles.
So, and they, the ones that just went through me, they're on their way somewhere else. And are they ever going to, I mean, what's, do we know? Do they ever stop? I mean, there's got to be some kind of energy, isn't there, to move them along?
Yeah, the ones traveling through our body, as we discussed earlier, most of them are from the sun or from the Big Bang, and they're very low energy.
Yeah.
And at those low energies, they're the least likely to interact. So they can travel, even if you imagine a giant planet or a giant star, they could travel light years through a star or a planet. It boggles the mind. So they travel, you know, these huge distances. But if you have enough atoms that you're monitoring, you can still detect them at these low energies. So, for example, neutrinos have been detected from the sun, and that's part of how we understand how the sun works and also how we understand the particle physics of neutrinos. At the very high energies where Ice Cube operates, they're much more likely to interact. So, for example, at the highest energies we study, they actually can't travel even all the way through the Earth.
Got it. We're talking today about the Ice Cube project and actually the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole with our two guests, Eleni Butterfield and Justin Vandenberg. And it's great to have them with us. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. We've had a lot of great questions here so far. What about you? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News as we talk with Eleni Butterfield and Justin Vandenberg about the Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center and the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole. And again, join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234. Eleni, I saw a photo of you, I even mentioned this earlier, of you with one of the sensors. Sensors look to be, what, 4 foot, maybe 3 foot, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
And they look conical?
Sort of. Egg-shaped?
Egg-shaped is the word. Egg-shape is the word. And as I looked at that picture and I thought, you know, you're dropping that thing a mile and a half down into, I don't know how many tons of pressure would be down there. And they better work.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get them back up, right?
Yeah, exactly. So all of our devices are rated, pressure rated, up to 10,000 PSI, because that is the level that we've seen the pressure spike to in Friesen for the original Ice Cube deployment. So all of the devices that went into the upgrade were tested and rated up to 10,000 PSI, in addition to all of the extreme temperatures that they will face at the South Pole.
What do they use for material? I mean...
Yeah.
You're not going to get this at the local sporting goods store.
So all of the glass is borosilicate glass. So they're all of our devices are housed in glass pressure vessels, which we source through a few different companies. One of them is based out of Germany. One of them is based out of Japan. Borosilicate glass, very strong and can withstand extreme pressure.
Yeah. Have any of them, Justin, ever broken, I mean, down there? How was it? I mean, it's been 20 years or better.
Since we've constructed Ice Cube 15 years ago, we've lost communication with something like 1% of all of the sensors. So, you know, 99% are still working fine after all these years under those huge pressures.
That's absolutely amazing to me. It shows too that there obviously a heck of a lot of thought went into how to construct these and then to test them and so that sort of thing before they went down. If you had that little of a loss, Barry in Madison has a question. Barry, hi.
Yes. I may have missed, you may have just been discussing my question, and that is how the collection devices are set up and I guess a description somehow just how they operate. And I just want to mention to Justin that, if I'm not mistaken, one of his colleagues 20 years ago was probably a young woman by the name of Kira. Because she's a friend of mine, and she was involved in the neutrino thing in Antarctica. I don't know if that rings a bell.
Yeah, Kira does not ring a bell, but that's one of the great things working on this project. It's hundreds of people around the world, and we get to work with so many of them get to know them, but that Kira does not ring a bell.
Well, what about the part of that Barry was asking was how do you collect or how's the data collection process? How does that work?
Yeah, so each of our digital optical modules in the ICE is made up of, for the original ICE Cube DOMs, one photomultiplier tube, which is an electronic device that can convert a photon or light into an electronic pulse. So that DOM will read the photon and then send it to the surface, what we call our main cable assembly, where it can be analyzed and sent over the satellite to the north. In the upgrade, all of our devices have more than one photomultiplier tube. They have multiple, which is part of the reason that the upgrade is aimed at like low-energy physics,
mm-hmm.
Because it's so much more dense. But they operate in the same way. So the light travels through the ice, and will be collected by that photomultiplier tube, converted into an electronic pulse, and then sent to the surface to be analyzed.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Chris in Evansville. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was just wondering, you know, are we someday, when humans may be living on the moon, are we going to get the same type of bombardment by neutrinos? Are they intergalactic? Do we need them to live in a healthy manner?
Yeah, well, that's a big question for you there, Justin.
Yeah, so you can think of the neutrinos as being among what's called cosmic rays or cosmic radiation, most of which is energetic atomic nuclei, protons and heavier nuclei. The neutrinos are another type of naturally occurring radiation. However, as we've discussed, they're very unlikely to ever hit an atom, so they don't pose any human health challenges.
Hmm, interesting. Lori, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Lori in Menasha, your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, sure. And it's such an awesome discussion. My questions were coming back to the facility itself, and I wondered, are you guys able to grow any kind of plant material, and is it at all possible to be self-sustaining there? Do you use renewable energy of any certain type that's fashioned for the facility? And my last question was, what do you think about the Project Hail Mary science? Because that was pretty interesting, too. And thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
So there's a small greenhouse at South Pole Station. That's about it in terms of, like, if we are self-sustainable, because South Pole is not habitable. There are no animals there. We saw a bird early in this season, and everyone was like, oh my gosh,
a bird.
We see life. So that was kind of funny. But yeah, so South Pole itself is actually not a place that life can be sustained, except on station. So all of our like food and stuff gets sent in via cargo. And then there's a small greenhouse for the people who stay there over the winter, so that they can have like fresh vegetables and stuff over the winter.
Yeah, there are people that stay year round.
Yes, not me, but there are people.
Yeah. John, I was going to ask a question, but I see John's got a good one, so let's go there. John, hi, in Mason.
Hi, I have a quick question. You may have answered it already, but I didn't hear it. Were neutrinos first theorized, or were they just discovered, and by whom?
Yeah.
Yeah, so neutrinos were theorized for a while before they were actually discovered. So we've talked a little bit about the different sources of neutrinos, the different types, and the different energy ranges. And one of the sources of neutrinos is in a radioactive decay, and that is how they were first discovered, was from a radioactive decay experiment. Justin, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, it was actually at a nuclear reactor. So neutrinos are produced abundantly at nuclear reactors, and they were discovered there for the first time in the 1950s, about 20 years after being theorized, theoretically, by Wolfgang Pauli.
And we did mention kind of in passing, but the UW leads this project, but it's a world. I mean, talk about the worldwide reach of this in terms of work.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about it. So it's over 450 authors on our papers now, and a lot of those people I've known as friends for 20 years now, and meeting new ones all the time. They're spread among 58 institutions on 14 countries. So it's a privilege to be here working at UW-Madison, which is the headquarters, and also to work with all those collaborators around the world.
Elisa emailed to ask if Delaney or Justin would go back to the South Pole, and if so, why?
I would go in a heartbeat. It was so much fun being down there. The people are amazing. The work is really hard, but it's really interesting, fulfilling work. And there's no place like it. I loved it there.
Yeah.
Me too. It's just a lot of fun to work hands-on. As a physicist, we spend a lot of our days working on very abstract thoughts and concepts and computer programming. But that's why I'm an experimental physicist, is to also do hands-on work with my hands.
Yeah. It's got to be a fascinating and fantastic experience. What's the largest, Mark wants to know from Duluth, what's the largest object we've discovered or observed in space? And Justin, what do you think?
I'll focus on mass rather than size. Paradoxically, some of the brightest objects in the universe are actually black holes, and they can grow to be millions or even billions of times the mass of the sun. It's a big mystery how they grow to be so large, so massive, and they act as particle accelerators, and that's one of the main things we're studying is why these giant black holes, how they can act as particle accelerators. And we've detected some that are up to almost a billion times the mass of the sun with IceCube.
Oh, and that's one of the virtues, I guess, of IceCube, isn't it?
Exactly.
What do you hope? I mean, down the road, you know, you're just kind of, in a way, Delaney, just getting started. You're probably going to be working on this. I won't be here 20 years from now to talk with you about this, but whoever takes my place might be.
Yeah, I've worked on the upgrade for my entire physics research career. So 1 year of my undergrad, and then I'm now almost 4 years into my PhD. So it was really, that's part of the reason it was so great to be down there and see it go into the ice. And I would just love to stay connected to the upgrade in any way I can throughout the rest of my PhD, whatever I do after my PhD. I really love the science that IceCube does, both the low energy side and the high energy side. I love working for the collaboration, and I think that IceCube is kind of just getting started.
And hopefully with funding and so forth, there are some rumblings about funding at the NSF and so forth. Hopefully we can keep that going.
Yeah, so building on the success of the construction of the IceCube upgrade that we've been discussing just in the last few months, we have a concept, a vision of a much larger upgrade to IceCube called IceCube Gen 2, IceCube Generation 2. And the idea is that we've made some major discoveries with IceCube. We've discovered that the universe itself is glowing from beyond the galaxy. The galaxy itself is glowing, but we don't know what's producing this glow. And so we need a much bigger detector to get beyond this tip of the ice cube, so to speak.
Okay. On that note, thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Justin Vandenbroek and Delaney Butterfield have been both working on this project, and it's great to learn more about it. And I appreciate their time, and I appreciate you listening in, and thank you so much for that, and of course the work of our team. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Stay with us. Lots more in store.